The time is 4 o'clock, time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of today's proms. It's presented by Christopher Cook.
A very warm welcome to the second of this year's proms organ recitals, played on the instrument here at the Royal Albert Hall, which is the second largest in Britain. And to play a programme of pieces that includes Bach, Reger, Franck and Liszt, we have one of the new generation of French player-composers, Thierry Escaich. Thierry Escaich belongs to a great tradition of French organists who are also serious composers. It's a tradition that dates back to the 17th century and which in our own time has included Louis Vienne, Marcel Dupré, Maurice de Rufflet and, of course, Olivier Messiaen. And it's perhaps a particularly Parisian tradition in that many of these composers have been associated with instruments belonging to the great churches in the French capital. So Thierry Escaich has been organist at the Church of Saint-Étienne du Mont in Paris since 1997. Organists, of course, have always improvised, filling the gaps in church services with devotional music. But in France, improvisation has become a great art. Indeed, it's been called composing in real time. And Thierry Escaich will begin and end his recital here in the Royal Albert Hall today with two such improvisations. During this afternoon's recital, we'll also hear music by the greatest of all organ masters, J.S. Bach, and by three important composers for the instrument from the Romantic era, César Franck, Max Reger, and Franz Liszt. But Thierry Escaich opens his recital with music that bridges the two poles, the complete span of his programme, an improvisation. So utterly contemporary and up to the minute, but in the style of the Baroque. So please welcome now to the mighty organ here at the Royal Albert Hall, Thierry Escaich.
Thank you.
Heathcote opening this afternoon's organ prom with improvisation in the Baroque style. The father of that Baroque style, of course, for the organ repertoire, as for so many others, is Johann Sebastian Bach. And next, Thierry Escaich plays Bach's choral prelude on the Advent hymn, Nun komm der Heiden Heiland, Come Now, Saviour of the Heathen. But the chorale melody is so highly decorated that you can barely recognise the original. Instead, it becomes a poignant and deeply affecting meditation on the yearning words with which the hymn begins. Come now, Saviour of the Heathen, acknowledged as the Virgin's child. After Bach, Thierry Escaich plays a piece of his own, based on the very chorale used by Bach. Evocation No. 3 was commissioned by the 2008 International Organ Competition in Graz as a test piece for the contestants in the final round. curious case, has just spent his own composition, Evo Classical No. 3, on the organ here at the Royal Albert Hall. And before that, Bach's choral prelude, Nun komm der Heiden Heiland, which was the musical starting point for his own piece. But now we move on to the other side of the River Rhine, closer to Bach, you might say, and to the German organist-composer of the 20th century who most consciously took up his mantle, Max Reger. Terry Eskesch is going to play the short chorale prelude Jauch, Erd und Himmel, Shout with Joy, O Earth and Heaven, composed in 1902. This is Bach filtered through Brahms with a heady dash of Wagner mixed in. A toccata-like fantasia on the manuals is set against the steady beat of the chorale tune on the pedals, before the heaven and earth are united in their jubilation on the whole instrument. Well, that was the very first performance at the BBC Proms of Max Reger's chorale prelude, Jauch, Erd und Himmel, played here on the organ at the Royal Albert Hall by Thierry Eskesch. And now I'm perched up in the organ loft above the Albert Hall stage with Thierry Eskesch. Thierry, what does it feel like to come to grips with a brand new organ, particularly one the size of this Royal Albert Hall organ?
It's every time very difficult to adapt to the organ. It's a very nice English organ. It's not my organ in Saint-Étienne-du-Mont, it's clear. But when we arrive before a concert, we have to practice 4 or 5 hours before. It's not possible to play just before a concert. We have to choose the stops, we have to select the stops, we have to discover the world of the work. It's very important. And after, we can make music.
It sounds as if what you have to do, as you were doing earlier here in the Albert Hall, is to make it personal, to make this your machine, your organ, your instrument for the time being.
Yeah, for instance, I have written my third evocation for organ. I wrote some registration on the paper, but when I come here, I have to transform. I have to adapt at the instrument. It's very, something very new. We do that every time.
You're going to end this afternoon's recital with an improvisation. We'll describe that later on. But I wonder, is improvisation, which is so much part of the great French tradition of organist composers, is this something that can be taught, or is this something you have to teach yourself?
I hope we can teach. I am professor. I am teacher of improvisation. I hope. No, it's very important for a teacher to help the student to discover their own world, musical world. It's very important to help finding their own musical world. And we can. The improvisation is the balance. It's the balance between the writing of musical writing, harmony, contrapunt, and it's the balance with the spontaneity. So we can help the student to find this balance between the two.
But presumably it's a little like flying, if I could take an analogy. You know, you can't fly at first, but gradually you have the confidence to fly, and after a while, you know, it becomes second nature and you can do all sorts of things. In other words, the capacity to improvise with the basic material must get greater the more you do it.
Before we improvise, at the end of the concert, in the end, I have to improvise a triptych. The project, global project, is a triptych in phonic. But I don't know where I go. The form is decided progressively. It's very important. The intensity, the emotional intensity grows poco a poco, progressively. It's very important. And at the end, it's a little bit a written piece.
You're going to play next for us, César Franck's Chorale No. 2 in B minor. How important do you think Franck is as a composer for the organ?
I think we can understand the music of Messiaen, for instance, of Vierne, of Tournemire, if we don't know the harmony of Franck. It's the ground of the music of the 20th century in France. And this chorale is very marvelous chorale. It's the last work of Franck. Franck has wrote this chorale just before he died.
Thierry Escaige, thank you very much indeed. And now we're going to hear César Franck's Chorale No. 2 in B minor, written in 1890 while the composer was recovering from injuries that he'd sustained during a carriage accident. Injuries, as Thierry has just told us, would eventually cost Franck his life later in life. This, then, is indeed one of the composer's last pieces for an instrument that he regarded as his full orchestra. Franck, though Belgian by birth, was the composer who rescued the French organ repertoire from the artistic doldrums into which it had fallen in the early part of the 19th century, when composers, and indeed their audiences, saw the organ as nothing much more than the purveyor of cheap effects and popular tunes. Franck brought back rigour, imagination, and artistic integrity in a whole canon of works which put organ literature back on the map as a serious art form. And nowhere more so than in a piece like this chorale, a great arch of music lasting 15 minutes, and a piece that the fine organist Dame Gillian Weir, herself no stranger to this mighty instrument, has compared to the tolling of a great bell as it moves from somber genesis through an avalanche of sound to its peaceful end. Palm of mind or passion spent, perhaps, there at the end of César Franck's chorale number 2 in B minor, played by Xavier Escaich, who ends his organ prom here at the Royal Albert Hall with a miniature by Franz Liszt, his adagio in D minor, a first performance of the proms in a season that's celebrating the 200th anniversary of the composer's birth in 1811. Originally a piano piece, it was later transcribed for the organ by the composer. The melody at the heart of the piece was invented by the sister of the Russian Tsar, no less, wife to the very grand Grand Duke of Saxe-Weimar-Eisenach. And after Liszt's adagio, there's more invention. Thierry Escaich is going to improvise at the Royal Hall Albert Hall organ on 2 themes by Liszt. Just before this afternoon's recital, he was handed these themes, both of them from works that we've heard at the proms earlier this year, the March from the Second Piano Concerto, which was played on the opening night, and the legend, St. Francis de Paolo Walking on the Water, which opened Marc-André Hamelin's recital, late night recital, 10 days ago. So Thierry Escaich has had a little under 45 minutes to think about these 2 themes, while also playing a full programme and talking to me. A genuine test of the art of improvisation, structured improvisation to composing in real time. remarkable feat of improvisation in the great tradition of the French organist composer. Thierry Escaiche has just improvised a triptych on two themes by Franz Liszt, the themes being the march from the second piano concerto, I'm a Legend, St. Francis de Paolo, Walking on the Water. Before that, he played Liszt's Adagio in D minor. The audience here in the Albert Hall warming to that extraordinary improvisation. A real piece of virtuoso play, with both themes quite clearly there and worked through so carefully. I don't think they're going to let Thierry Escaiche go home quite as fast as he would like to. He was telling me that last night he was playing in Luxembourg and came by train to London today for this afternoon's recital, turning to the organ loft here at the Albert Hall, and that he returns to France where he has two recitals this week. There is to be an encore. Thierry Escaiche has just played a transcription of the last movement of Handel's fifth organ concerto, the encore of his recital here at the Royal Albert Hall. And we shall be returning, or Radio 3 will be returning, to the Royal Albert Hall later this evening for this evening's BBC Prom. It's the last of Proms in our Choral Sunday series. Just one work, Beethoven's Mighty Missa Solemnis, for the quartet and soloists that includes Sarah Connolly and Matthew Rose. Sir Colin Davies conducts the London Symphony Orchestra and the London Symphony Chorus, and that's at 7 o'clock this evening. But for now, for a brief while, it's goodbye from the Royal Albert Hall as I hand you back to Jill Anderson for the rest of this Sunday afternoon on Radio 3.
Thank you very much, Christopher. Christopher Cook at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, in about 10 minutes' time, we'll be going over to the Royal College of Music for our Proms Plus Choral Sunday. As Christopher said, our prom this evening is a performance of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, and in the Choral Sunday, Sarah Moore Peach and members of the London Symphony Orchestra will be exploring the piece, drawing on recorded examples and live music too. So that happens at 5:15, and you can hear that live here on Radio 3. Meanwhile, here's a transcription of one of Bach's organ pieces for four recorders, which I suppose are organ pipes that have finger holes. This is a Prelude and Fugue in C minor, BWV 537, and here to play it is the Amsterdam Lucky Stardust Quartet.
Thank you.
Bach's Prelude and Fugue in C minor, BWV 537, played by the Amsterdam Lucky Stardust Quartet. And here they are again in an air by Matthew Locke. The Amsterdam Lucky Stardust Quartet playing an air by Matthew Locke from the Suite No. 3 in F. This is BBC Radio 3, now live from the Royal College of Music. We've Proms Plus, presented this afternoon by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Thank you, Jill. Welcome to the Royal College of Music, to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, a packed hall. Lovely to see everybody here. We're going to be looking at Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, which is being performed tonight by Sir Colin Davis and the London Symphony Orchestra. And I'm joined by three members of the orchestra, violinist Maxine Kwok Adams, flautist Gareth Davis, and trombonist Katie Jones. Welcome to you all. Can I start by asking you a little bit about your history with the orchestra? Gareth, you've been there a while, haven't you?
I have. This is my 12th year. I've just started. It's been an exciting ride so far, that's for sure.
And you also have some kind of connection to the self-governing nature of the LSO, don't you?
Yes, I am the vice chairman of the orchestra. As you said, we're a self-governing orchestra, so we make all the decisions. So it's an interesting role to play the flute 1 minute and then have to do lots of other paperwork and emails, thousands of emails,
I have
to say.
Poor you. And Katie, how long have you been playing with them?
I'm probably one of the newer members of the orchestra. I've only been a member of the orchestra for about 4 years now, but I was working with the orchestra for a few years before that as a freelance player.
And your co-principal trombone, how does that work?
Well, the principal trombone is Dudley Bright, and he does a large proportion of the principal trombone work, but I take sort of pick up the slack, I suppose, and as well as playing principal trombone, I often find myself playing second or bumping. A large programme on tour, bumping, sorry.
It's one of those words that you hear bandied around all the time. But
jargon, yeah. Brass player jargon. It's basically if it's a really heavy piece to play, something like Bruckner often uses a bumper, then it means we can play in longer phrases, and it helps us to, the bumper's job is to help the principal.
Right. And Maxine, how long have you been with the LSO?
I started with the LSO in 98 on the String Experience Scheme, which we still run, and I joined in 2001, so it's my 10th year anniversary this month, actually, as a permanent member of the orchestra.
Oh, congratulations.
So, thank you.
Have you celebrated in any way?
I'm going to try and make some cupcakes for the section. I had a little go last week, and
this is for the whole string section. Or
no,
just
the first violin.
So this is where you wish you played the trombone, right?
It wasn't a great success, so I have to try again, and it'll probably be a celebration towards the end of the month.
Great. You can test them out on the trombone section.
Test them out on everybody here. Now, Katie, we've got a flute and a violin, but you've got a trombone in your hand. It doesn't look like your regular trombone. Tell us about it. What kind is it?
It's not. Ordinarily, you'd probably see a B-flat trombone on stage, but for Beethoven, it's an alto trombone part. So it's pitched in E-flat, which is a fourth above normal, and it's a lot smaller.
It looks much squatter.
It is, yes. It's a lot shorter length of pipe, which is what makes it the fourth higher.
Is there a different tone to it as well?
Yes, it's a much brighter colour to the instrument.
Could you give us just a note to show us?
It's just a sweeter sound and lighter and brighter, and it goes with the string sound much better. It works in a sort of classical environment well.
And how has the rehearsal process worked up to this point? I know you had a rehearsal this morning, which ended quite early, giving you lots of time to hang out in South Kensington. How have you rehearsed this piece up till now? Has it been continuous over the last few days?
Yeah, we've been rehearsing over the last few days. We started off just with the solo singers and the orchestra, and then the chorus came the next day. A lot of the music that we play in the orchestra is actually doubling the vocal lines of the choir. So it was just like a quieter version without words, really, for the first day. And we got everything sorted like that, and then the choir comes in, because, of course, then it's much more difficult because there's an awful lot of people on stage this evening. And in the Albert Hall, which is a pretty big place, everybody's stretched out over a big place. So a lot of the rehearsal was actually making sure everything's together, because obviously Colin's quite a long way away, even from where I sit, so I have no idea what the bass is. Get to see probably a slight time delay, I'd imagine.
And I mean, actually, no, that is a real problem in the Albert Hall, the issue of time delay, that the stage is so huge. I've certainly know it, experiencing it from sitting right at one side of the stage. There's a sort of fluttering across as, different parts hit the bar, bar line.
You can sometimes hear the notes go round. It's like you play a note and it goes round and you hear it again. That wasn't a joke, that's true.
It definitely has its challenges as a space.
It's unique.
So you have to find unique ways to get around those problems, do you?
Yes.
That's all you're saying.
Trade secret. No, there's anticipation that goes on. You have to listen. I mean, you listen anyway when you play in the orchestra, despite the fact there's a conductor there. But when you've got to be together with everybody, there's a sort of collective gelling of everything together, which that's what the rehearsal's for. I mean, we all know the piece. It's just getting it together.
You say you know the piece. Is it something that you play often, the Missa Solemnis?
I've never played it before.
You haven't, actually?
No, I've never played it before either, I have to admit. I think it's a very challenging piece to perform. This evening we've got a huge choir, and a space like the Albert Hall is a fantastic place to perform it. But it's very challenging parts. You were saying yourself earlier how high the soprano parts are, and to find choruses that are willing and able to tackle such repertoire, it's going to be more difficult, I think.
Yeah. It is an unusual piece in that way, that I've heard it described as the most famous piece of music you've never heard. And it is true that it is very rarely performed. And that's one of the things that I'd like to look at when we talk about the piece of music, why it is that it's so rarely performed. I think basically you've answered it already. It's so huge. It calls for an awful lot of people, and it is a massive sing and a massive play as well. I mean, do you guys get tired out performing something like this? Be honest.
No. Well, as I said...
Now that's stamina.
Well, I mean, it's not too long. It's less taxing, I think, probably for all of us than a big Mahler symphony. And as I said, a lot of what we're doing is accompanying. So it's kind of, the sopranos can only get so high. I can get quite a lot higher than they can. on a good day, anyway. But So actually, as it's accompanying, it's not quite as full on. There's very few moments, certainly for me, anywhere where I'm exposed as a solo instrument. So it's sort of relaxing in a way.
Well, let's get on with the music and have a little listen to how it starts, and then just pick apart some of the sort of key aspects to listen out for when we hear it tonight. We've got a CD recording of the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus and Sir Colin Davis conducting. This is the opening of the Kyrie. So one of the things I think that characterises the Missa Solemnis, and there's a good reason for it, is ascending and descending figures. It's very simple, up and down. The Missa Solemnis is one of Beethoven's late works. He considered it one of his greatest achievements, and it was intended for the church, although he didn't ever hear a full performance of it in his lifetime. But it's basically Beethoven's statement of his faith and his sense of spiritual belief. He was brought up a Catholic, but it's not that he lost his Catholic faith, but he sort of expanded his understanding of spirituality into something sort of massive and pantheistic. And he kept mystical quotes about God and the divine underneath the glass of his writing desk so he could look at them. And I think the way in which this ascending and descending is his expression of his spiritual belief is the idea of man or humanity or earth reaching up to the heavens and simultaneously the divine descending and becoming manifest on earth. So although in that opening bit of the Kyrie you kind of hear this sense of striving upwards, the motif that the violins start with, which I'm going to ask Maxime to play, actually starts off with a falling interval, and the Kyrie is really a prayer of mercy. Christ and Lord, have mercy upon us. Maxine, could you just play what you do at the very beginning? Thank you very much. So you can hear it all kind of seems to slip downwards. And I want to just go through and ask you all to kind of pick out some other moments where there are similarly descending and then ascending scales. So at the end of the Sanctus, and the words that this goes to are Hosanna in Excelsis. Katie, can you play what the trombone does? So that phrase starts with a rising motif, and while the first trombone is doing that, the bass trombone is actually busy descending and going the other way, called contrary motion. Anyone who's ever practiced their piano scales knows contrary motion is one hand goes in one direction, the other goes in the other direction, and then they turn around and go the other way. So let's just have a listen to what that bit sounds like. There's a solo violin in this part of the Sanctus, it's the Benedictus, and you'll hear how the choir and the violin and all of the other parts are doing exactly that, working in contrary motion. So that's the end of the Sanctus, the Benedictus. And now let's skip to the final movement, which is very interesting and we'll come to later. But this is the Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God. And this is a prayer of supplication. So as you'd expect, it's all descending. Maxine, can you play us a bit of the first violin part? Thank you, Maxine. From a purely practical point of view, does it ever get boring playing scales like that?
It depends in what sort of context. In this, it's all weaving around, and it's actually, that's quite an interesting bit for us in context of the whole piece, because a lot of it is just doubling and just chords, and not the most thrilling sort of first violin part you would ever get in Beethoven. If you consider he wrote the Ninth Symphony around the same time, it doesn't really compare, but there are so many beautiful moments, and I think that is one of them in the context of the whole piece.
Let's hear it in context. We've got it on record.